Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, a show featuring the people, stories, and events of Central Iowa. I'm your host for the day, Greta Anderson. Welcome to October. The weekend was a good one for outdoors enthusiasts, despite the spit and sputter from Saturday's skies. Quite a contrast to the previous weekend, when Mother Nature dumped a ton of water right on Ames. Later in the show, Keith Morgan joins us to give us a rundown of the flash flood event that ensued and how City of Ames employees worked together to address the emergency. Also on the emergency front, we hear about efforts to eliminate fleas from the public library. Other than that, today's show focuses on a number of upcoming cultural events in our neighborhood. Eric McIntyre gives us the backstory on the pieces he's selected for the Central Iowa Symphony concert coming up this Saturday. Our first segment, though, addresses tonight's lecture at Memorial Union, focusing on the culture in agriculture. The lecture is entitled Khrushchev and Corn, A Brief History of Iowa Agriculture, and is given by Liz Garst. Liz was just a girl in 1959 when the Soviet premier came to Iowa to visit the farm of her grandfather, Roswell Garst. Liz is now deeply involved in White Rock Conservancy, the 5,500-acre public land trust created from the Garst fortune. Here's my talk with her. So, Liz, you were how old when the Soviet premier, Nikita Khrushchev, came to Iowa and visited your grandfather's farm?
I was 8 years old.
And you have vivid memories of that?
I do. I remember getting kissed by Khrushchev and sitting on Mrs. Khrushchev's lap and all the TV reporters. I have lots of fun memories of it.
And what was your overall impression of this Soviet leader?
He was very much like my granddad. He was loud and boisterous and a little bit scary.
Okay, and do you think, was he pleased with his visit?
I think he had fun. One of my main impressions of the day was everybody had fun, including Khrushchev. He knew how to have fun. There was a lot of press and a lot of commotion during the event. There were lots of people, and it was noisy and confusing from the perspective of an 8-year-old.
Right. You were aware that it had great significance, but probably at your age you didn't really know exactly what that was.
Right. And I didn't understand how significant it was till a lot later.
Okay. And that's really what your talk is going to be about, the significance of this moment, both for Russia and for Iowa.
Mm-hmm. Iowa was, during this era, the absolute leader of productivity and agriculture in the whole world. And that's why this event happened, was because of the quality and the innovation in our agriculture. And my grandfather was very involved in that era, in the explosion of the productivity of agriculture. And so we were showing off not just to Khrushchev, but to the whole world.
Uh-huh. This was post-World War II, actually. It was much after it, 1959. We know that a lot of the productivity came from chemicals, the use of chemicals in agriculture, and also your grandfather was a pioneer in hybridization?
Yes. My grandfather was very involved in a lot of different phases of agriculture, but by far the most important and the starting point, the foundation of our productivity was our genetics. Hybrid seed corn made a huge difference in our agriculture, not only because of the yields it provided, but we needed to have a standardized corn crop through corn breeding so we could mechanize corn production, which was the next big innovation. In 1929, we were still hand-picking corn, and in 1959, the Russians didn't have corn, but if they did, they would have been hand-picking it. The hybridization of the crop helped make it uniform enough so that we could mechanize production, and that made a huge difference, as well as the genetics. Then the next revolution that came along was the chemical one, but first was hybrids and mechanization.
Okay.
Another reason Khrushchev came was not just because of the corn production, but what we did with the corn. Khrushchev was intensely interested in getting more protein in his nation's diet, meat, milk, and eggs. And that's, of course, why we grow corn, to make meat, milk, and eggs.
So, yeah, I was going to ask that. I don't associate the Soviet Union or Russia with corn. It seems like a wheat-growing region. Did they pick up corn after this visit? Did they start growing corn?
Yes. Khrushchev wanted to grow corn, and a lot of the country is highly, a lot of the former Soviet Union is highly unsuitable for corn, where they have good soils, which is in the Ukraine, the climate's dry and much further north than Iowa. Where they have good climate, which would be, for example, Georgia, they don't have any soil. It's just red clay there. So they don't have a great mix of soil and climate to produce any grain, to tell you the truth. Khrushchev introduced corn after his initial exposures to Iowa agriculture. He overdid it. He was known as corn crazy. He planted corn in Siberia. And he got thrown out of office after only 9 years. And one reason was he just overplayed his hand in a lot of ways, including in corn production. So though he overdid it, it is still, the corn is such a high-yielding, productive, it produces unbelievable calories per acre. And so it was adopted by the Soviet Union after the exposure to Iowa, and even today the Ukraine's a pretty big corn-growing area.
And is it mostly for production of livestock then?
Yes. Number two yellow corn, what we grow in this state, is it's also for ethanol now and, of course, export. But it's all field corn or corn for animals. The sweet corn market isn't very big.
I wonder, in your talk is subtitled A Brief History of Iowa Agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wonder if you get into the Russia Iowa connection later on in the Earl Butz proclamation of get big or get out.
No, I don't follow the story that far. I basically go from 1929 to 1970 as told through the eyes of my grandfather.
Oh, okay. So what sources did you draw on in order to prepare for this?
I think that the main books that document the story are the biography of my grandfather by Harold Lee, An American Dreamer, which is about Henry Wallace, who has a huge amount to do with this story and the politics of Iowa. And then there's also a really good biography of Khrushchev. And between those three biographies, the story lies. I also am the oldest in my family. I spent a lot of time on my grandparents' farm. Even as I was a young adult, I paid a lot of attention to my grandfather and my uncle John Crystal, who was also part of the story. So family lore is a major source for this story. You know, what my parents and grandparents told me.
Interesting. It sounds like you could write a book about this as well as present a lecture.
We'll see.
What are you looking forward to in tonight's lecture?
I enjoy sharing the story, and I enjoy getting feedback from people who still remember the story. And I suspect that tonight there will be some people around who will have stories to share with me, which I think will be great. Roswell had a huge amount to do with Iowa State University. He interacted with them a lot, especially their animal science department. He was very interested in how we feed cattle in this country. And there are people around who still remember all that. So mm-hmm. I'm looking forward to hearing what the audience has to say.
Well, it sounds like it'll be a fun evening for you, and it'll be fun to hear some of this cultural, historical background to what is so on the minds of so many people in this town.
I think the story is fun. I hope one of my main goals is to make people laugh and enjoy themselves. And I think the story has implications in our current state of world affairs and future state of affairs. There's some timeless lessons in how we should all get along with each other, told in the story of why Roswell and Khrushchev got along.
Wonderful. Well, once again, that's tonight, 7 p.m. at Memorial Union, Liz Garst presenting Corn and Khrushchev, A Brief History of Iowa Agriculture. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye. You're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm Greta Anderson. Switching gears now from agriculture to high culture and looking forward to the end of the week, I spoke with Eric McIntyre to hear what he had to say about the music he chose for the fall concert, entitled From On High and Down Below. Eric, it sounds like you have an exciting adventure for us this coming Saturday, October 8 at 7:30.
Indeed, we do.
I'm seeing all kinds of things I've never seen before, including a tuba concerto.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I think is really exciting about this program, in that there's going to be a lot of things that people might not have heard performed before, and indeed a tuba concerto is one of those. But also, I was just thrilled to find that even the concertmaster for the orchestra for this concert said he had never played any of the works on this program.
The concertmaster, tell me about what that role is.
Concertmaster is the first chair, first violinist, who's considered the leader of the string section, and takes care of leadership within the violin section, but also the entire strings, and therefore sort of the musician who's the leading the orchestra beyond the conductor's responsibilities.
And in this mostly volunteer symphony, the Central Iowa Symphony, would that position be a paid position, a professional position?
They're volunteer musicians, some receive an honorarium that's tied to the responsibility of their position, such as a concertmaster. It's usually occupied by someone who is a professional musician. So we have a regular concertmaster who is also a member of the Des Moines Symphony as a violinist, but also a German professor at Iowa State University. And for this concert, though, we have a substitute concertmaster because the academic duties of our regular concertmaster have pulled him away for this weekend.
And who did you recruit to play the tuba?
The tubist is Beau Atlas, who is the principal tubist of the Des Moines Symphony. And, you know, it's really fantastic to have a tubist who is virtuosic enough to play this concerto because it's by no means an easy piece of music.
Yeah, I just think of tubas generally with marching bands.
Well, the tuba is definitely the foundation of the brass section in an orchestra as well. It's one thing about a marching band is that you have to have mobile instruments, so you can't have string basses, for example, to hold up the bottom. But in an orchestra, especially, you can have the tuba and the basses together, which gives you a lot of foundation. But indeed, it's normally a section instrument as part of the low brass with the trombones. There are very few tuba concertos out there where the tubist is the soloist.
And speaking of marches, the concert starts off with what's called Hungarian March, Damnation of Faust. So this is part of a drama, the story of Faust, and how does there come to be a march in the middle of this drama?
Well, this was actually, the march was written by Berlioz for a Hungarian tour, and so he wanted to have something that would rouse the locals and win some support, and so he decided to include this march, which is, the melody of the march is based in farther back antiquity, but it's a Hungarian national tradition. And so he had this march inserted in the show, and when he describes the way it was premiered, that by the time the big march theme came back near the end of the work, he said the audience was just worked into a frenzy. So he wrote it, he brought it into the drama especially to win some extra kudos from the local audience.
Faust is the character who Well, in the modern lingo, he might be the one who, you know, the guy goes down the crossroads and sells his soul to the devil.
Oh,
but
right, yeah, in the Robert Johnson story. And
yeah, but in this case, he's he wants great knowledge. Faust yep. wanted knowledge, and so the march is rousing up people's excitement about Faust being condemned for this breach of human barriers.
I wish I could say that it actually served a role like that, but there's a long tradition in opera of and in musical drama settings like this of taking something that doesn't normally fit in the show and plugging it in to appease a certain audience. And the same would be Mozart, for example, might have an aria that's not from an opera, and if he was going to perform it in a certain city and there was a famous singer that he wanted to show off, he would take that aria and stick it into the opera, even if it wasn't related to it.
Oh, okay. And Berlioz, what year or what decade would this be performed?
Berlioz was working in across the 19th century. He rose to great fame in the early part of the 19th century, and so it's high romanticism.
Okay. Well, speaking of romanticism, then we have a piece from Wagner.
Yes. So in contrast, this program that I call From On High and From Down Below, we have the Damnation of Faust Hungarian March, which has sinister overtones and seems to be coming from below. And then we have the Vaughan Williams Tuba Concerto, which is, again, featuring a low instrument. And the Accursed Hunter, which is dealing with demons chasing someone. But the Wagner is the Good Friday spell from Parsifal. So this is something that's aspiring to something on high and has serious spiritual and religious overtones. So it's a nice contrast with the other works on the program.
And that, too, has a kind of narrative setting.
Yes.
Can you elaborate on that a bit?
I'm no great Wagner scholar, but the idea in Parsifal, which is a tremendous opera, we're talking well over 5 hours, but this is one of the centerpieces of the music where it's not sung. It's all about the drama of the moment that this spell is being cast, and the thing, well, as with many people with Wagner, you can pull out orchestral sections of it that don't feature voices at all. And so that's what this one is. It's one that, and where we often think of Wagner as big and blustery with lots of brass, this one is far more intimate. The full brass section only play at the very beginning and at one chord at the very end, and the rest of it is primarily woodwind strings and horns. So it's not the blustery Wagner we think of.
Huh. Okay. And no voices, either.
No voices.
Right. Parsifal is an archetypal hero.
Yes. Well, Parsifal is the one who finds the Holy Grail in the Arthurian legends. And Wagner, of course, loved these legends with long, deep roots, and especially things that might aim towards, in his case, a lot of the time, nationalist bents.
Yeah. I noticed that that's another theme of your show, incidentally.
Sure, yeah.
And then you close out with something César Franck, what you call a tone poem.
Yes.
And what is a tone poem?
A tone poem is a piece of music that is programmatic, meaning that it's built around a story, sometimes literally a musical portrayal of a poem, but sometimes just a narrative story. The great creators of tone poems would be people like Franz Liszt, and especially Richard Strauss, who did tone poems about familiar figures, Don Juan and Don Quixote, and then things like Death and Transfiguration. And César Franck, who was writing in many ways in a very Germanic style, and his work, especially this work, is a very Wagnerian work, bases it on a story that, of course, predated the music, of a huntsman who, denying the Sabbath, decides to hunt on a Sunday. And he blows his horn and calls together his hunters. And in the background, we hear the church bells and the the pious congregation and him with his raucous hunting horns. And you can hear in the music the sounds of pleas to him to stop and to go to the church. But instead he chooses to go on the hunt. And he pays the price. So in the story, he ends up finding himself alone in the woods, and his horse won't move forward or backward. And then demons start rising up. He receives the curse, and he's cursed to be hunted by demons and hellhounds for eternity.
Oh, my goodness. This
wild ride of a piece.
Another really Faustian figure,
yes.
Like you said.
Yeah. He definitely pays the price.
Wow. So this sounds, as you bill it, as an uncommon journey. You've been with the Central Iowa Symphony for how many years now?
I believe it's 8. I think this is my 8th season.
And besides that, you are a professor at Grinnell?
Yes. I teach music composition and conduct the Grinnell Symphony Orchestra.
So tell us what you enjoy about working with the Central Iowa Symphony.
It's a unique orchestra. I mean, there's so many community orchestras around the country and in Iowa, but this is one of the few, if not the only one, where the entire orchestra is there every week. And so while some orchestras have a model of hiring a lot of people to come in the day before the concert and doing one full rehearsal, and then some have they hire a lot of ringers to come in to fortify the group, this group rehearses with the full ensemble every week, and that allows me a lot of flexibility for programming. Not only can I program unusual works like this, but I can program works that require lots of intense rehearsal, like for our December concert, Brahms' First Symphony, which, in all honesty, I would not program with an orchestra that I could not rehearse with regularly, especially involving a lot of amateur musicians, that is, people who are playing for the love of it rather than for their livelihood. You need that familiarity that comes with regular rehearsal, hearing all the parts there. But also as a conductor, to get your thumbprint on the sound, to make it sound the way you want and get the interpretation you're looking for, you need to either have a group, you know, that's so high up with people who do nothing but play all the time and you can make an imprint on them on a first rehearsal, or you need more rehearsals. And so the fact that we have rehearsals with the full ensemble allows us to play, I would say, more confidently and more difficult music. And for me, as an interpreter of the music, to have my fingerprints on it.
Uh-huh. And you've decided what the symphony will play throughout the entire season.
Yes.
Do you spend your summer kind of, yes, dreaming up these shows?
The summer, hopefully more in the year before, and sometimes several years in advance, depending on, you know, how we're going to secure soloists. And it's that's my role as music director. So I'm the conductor is the one who runs the rehearsals and leads the concert, but the music director is the one who has the vision for the artistic side of the organization. And I consider everything from what kinds of pieces an audience might like, what kinds of things I would like to do, and especially what kind of things are good for the orchestra. And so we have this orchestra in particular is noted for having adventurous programming. We do definitely some standard war horses, but we also do a lot of things that you don't hear that often, especially with community orchestras. And so I consider things that will make the players better and make us work as an ensemble in different ways. And I consider things that will make it a growing experience for our audience. I hope that by the end of a season, everyone has new ears.
Oh, how nice. Okay, well, we will look forward to your concert, the Central Iowa Symphony concert, called From On High and Down Below, Saturday, October 8th at 7:30. Thank you so much for taking some time to preview that show.
Great. Thank you very much.
All right. Bye-bye. And once again, that was Eric McIntyre of Central Iowa Symphony, and that concert will be held in the Ames Auditorium. What announcement on the cultural, a couple of announcements actually on the cultural theme, this one for children. youth will have an opportunity to showcase their talent at this year's Ames Has Talent competition. Ames Has Talent is, of course, patterned after America's Got Talent and is open to performers grades K through 12. And the event will be held on Sunday, October 16th. You can register to compete, and you must register to compete by October 10th at the Ames Children's Choir website. That's www.ameschildrenschoirs.org. Or you can call 515-290-1422. We'll have that on our website with the posting of this show. There is an entry fee, but audience admission will be a free will donation. And now we have a word from the Ames Community Arts Council.
Hello, my name is Connor Keenan, and I'm an intern for the Ames Community Arts Council, inviting you to the 2016 Ames Area Studio Tour. October 8th and 9th, 20 Ames area artists will open their studios to the public for a great inside look at local art. Here's a little bit more about Kakab Merchant and her 4U2C studio. Kakab is a multimedia artist from Pakistan. She came to Chicago in the summer of 1992 after being encouraged by her colleagues to come to America to visit the museums and art galleries. 2 years later, she married her husband and moved back to America. She then went to the UK after receiving a field fellowship from the government. She taught at Commonwealth Institute and visited the art galleries there for 4 months. After her son was born, she settled with her husband in Ames. When she was in school, Kakab never thought she could be an artist. After high school, her principal asked her to teach an arts class for children before she headed to college. The class's topic was Japanese art. They took a first place award in their local community. She then went to college and realized she could continue making her own artwork. After earning a graduate degree in graphic design, she taught for 4 years at the college she had been attending. She was thrilled when her paintings were chosen to be in the college's commercial art gallery. It was a turning point of her career. She worked very hard on her craft. She's one of the first women artists in Pakistan and received a scholarship for a book designing and illustrating course in Lahore, Pakistan. There, she designed an author's book cover and illustrated children's textbooks. She would also illustrate her father's books. When her son was still young, Kakab designed a papier-mâché ornament. This was selected to be a papier-mâché ornament for the White House collection from Iowa. Laura Bush invited Kakab to the White House to see the grand Christmas tree. This was one of the many honors Kakab was received in her art career. She's continually inspired by everyday designs in the world. When making three-dimensional art, she's very influenced by Roman architecture. She's also inspired by many artists painting from her home country of Pakistan. If Kakab had to give advice to beginners in art, it is to not give up. Everyone must start somewhere. You can accomplish anything. Kakab is experienced with nearly every medium of art and is always willing to teach others her craft. She believes sharing ideas with one another, as she learned while making art in Pakistan, is the best way to get involved in art projects. To learn more about Kakab and her 4U2C studio, please join us on our Ames Area Studio Tour from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Saturday, October 8th, and from noon to 4 p.m. Sunday, October 9th. Don't forget about the after party from 6 to 9 p.m. Saturday night, October 8th. For more information, please visit www.amesart.org. www.amesart.org.
And Kakab Merchant, that artist that was profiled in that segment, her studio is on McCarthy Road off of Gaskill. So if you are interested in checking out her artwork, you can visit her this weekend. This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and we now trip from the sublime to the somewhat more mundane, exploring a couple of emergencies, minor and major, in Ames last week. On the phone, we have Jerry Hyde, Youth Services Specialist at Ames Public Library and Commander-in-Chief of the Flea Patrol, while Library Director Lynn Carey was away. Jerry, what can you tell us about the flea situation at the library as it developed last week and as it stands now?
Well, Wednesday was a very interesting day, but we did get everything all taken care of and under control after consulting several experts in the field, including the entomologist at Iowa State University and our pest control person who came in on Wednesday evening and sprayed the library. And then vacuuming is the number two ways of taking care of our little fleas. and they were fleeing around and got vacuumed up. Our custodial staff have been vacuuming diligently since Wednesday, and every morning the whole library itself, and has gotten everything under control.
So no more fleas have been spotted.
Well, fleas have been spotted, but as our preferred pest person told us, that is a typical thing because there are four different stages of a flea. So when we sprayed, we got, if they were in a different stage, the larva stage, then they would hatch. And then there would be some live ones there, but the vacuuming, the continued vacuuming is taking care of that part of it. And he will be back in, well, now about 10 days from now. To spray again and then in the areas that we're seeing those.
Okay. It's funny. Just last week I was reading John Donne's poem, The Flea, with a friend. So, and I'm wondering whether this crisis has had you thinking immediately of children's books about insects.
Well, you know, the children's books are always on my mind, and I can't say that I was thinking about the different fleeing type of books, but I did think of the Napping House, where the flea bites the mouse and causes all that havoc, and that is somewhat what we had for a little while, but it was taken care of wonderfully by both staff and the management team, and again, I can't say enough for our custodial staff and Bo for attacking it as diligently as humanly possible.
That's Bo Duckett.
Yes, a maintenance manager.
Well, thanks so much for taking time to give us this update, Jerry Hyde.
Not a problem. Thank you.
All right. And that was Spanish Flea, and it's also some kind of transition for a game show, and I can't remember what one it was, but while we were listening to that, we had a procession of very distinguished men from Ames coming into the studio. With us is Keith Morgan, Emergency Services Manager of Story County, and of course, the major emergency that we had last week was a great deal of flooding and wet basements and things like that. Tell us, Keith, what happened, what was going on, and then introduce our distinguished guests.
Sure. I'll give you it from my perspective. It started off, we started getting some heavy rain. The National Weather Service had forecast that there was a chance of flash flooding in the area. So we were up watching it, and there was quite a bit of training, as we call it, where storms will develop very rapidly, dump their rain, and then dissipate, and that was happening. And as we were watching the storms during the evening, you could see that happening just to the west of us in Boone. There, the storms were developing and moving right over Ames and dropping it. This was Thursday night going into Friday morning. I was watching over the whole county, but we could see that there was issues happening in Ames in the number of streets that were starting to flood, and that there were cars being trapped. And about, if I remember right, it was somewhere around 1 o'clock in the morning, I had a discussion with Chief Tykosh on what was going on, and he invited me on down to his emergency operations center. And at that point, I'll turn it over to Chief Tykosh, and he can talk about how the event developed here in Ames.
Well, it was kind of a difficult storm. We were at the center of this series of thunderstorms that Keith described, and any time there's unsettled weather, we'll monitor that weather. The staff over at the water plant monitor the rivers, and the Weather Service keeps us really quite well informed about the risk. This one just kept, this storm just kept raining on Ames, and so we did not experience the river flooding that we're accustomed to, but what we did experience is this flash flooding where our roadways turned into rivers themselves. And so we had roadways with 2 and 3 feet of water running down them. And it just really challenged the capacity of the storm sewer system. Certainly across the community, we had people who had basements affected. We had a couple of basements that got a lot of water in them. And we had one basement wall collapse. And so the fire crews were pretty busy with those. And then we had so many disabled vehicles and stranded motorists across town. We had 2 shifts of police officers in trying to make sure those folks were out of danger. We weren't necessarily able to get all of the cars out during the storm, but we got the people out of danger. And it was a situation where we opened our emergency operations center in preparation for any additional assistance that our on-duty crews might need. And so we had 2 shifts of police officers. We had fire crews out. We had electric crews in. We had water people monitoring the storm. And that was all working fairly well, but we were getting close to the edge where we might need some extra help. And that's when we invited Keith and the city manager and some of our other emergency operations center down to help us monitor this thing and just see if we were going to ride it out or have more damage across the city.
Wow. So what were the most dramatic kind of rescues that you had to make?
Well, we had in the field, we had a disabled person in a motor vehicle, and the water was deep enough that we didn't feel like we could get there confidently with a patrol vehicle. So we used a fire truck, which has a little greater clearance, to get to that vehicle and get that disabled individual along with the other occupants out of that. It was important, maybe not dramatic. It wasn't really a close call, but it was important. They were fearful and in a vulnerable situation. We had a couple of people in basements who were at risk. We had some a couple of elderly folks who were in their basements in some pretty deep water, and so one of the things we needed to get them out of there until the storm passed. And they didn't need to be wading around in waist-deep water with unresolved electrical and gas issues in the home. So fire folks dealt with a few of those.
Wow. And where did these people go when they got taken out of their homes that were...
Well, they went a lot of places. One woman went to her car, and that was her preference. Keith and his crew notified the Red Cross in the event that we needed sheltering, and so we were prepared to shelter individuals. What we've discovered, though, in Ames is that many people have a preference to go and stay with friends or family nearby, and that's where most of our folks ended up.
Wow.
And in many cases, these were temporary relocations until the water went down, so folks who had a stranded car, they went into a nearby building and waited for the storm to pass and went out and hoped their car started.
And some of the stuff that we were working on, we were right at the cusp of sending out a message. And this is – there's 2 points to what we had occur. First off, if you see that there's water over the road, don't assume your car can make it across. There were 14-plus people, if I remember right, that gambled on that and lost. And their cars probably suffered considerable damage, and we did have to rescue 2 people. Don't put our first responders in that situation. You've heard us say it over and over again. Turn around, don't drown, because you can't tell how deep that water is or even if there's a road underneath there. Another aspect to this is we were about to use the Story County, Iowa Alerts, which is that mass notification system I've talked about before. And this would have been a prime example of why people need to go to our website, which is the Story County website, and look for emergency management and sign up for Story County, Iowa Alerts so that their cell phone will get the message too, because most people don't have a landline anymore. So we need people to sign up their cell phone so that we can tell them if we're running into a situation like this so that people can take care of themselves during these kind of events.
So you might have told them about particular roads that were out or just the fact that there was flash flooding, don't leave your home?
Exactly, especially if there are certain areas that we're identifying that are vulnerable, especially if we do have more of the river flooding, we can actually draw polygons, as we call it, around the rivers and the creeks that might be flooding and warn those people only in that area that there's potential for flooding in their area. But they've got to be signed up because, again, most people don't have a landline, and that's the only information we've been able to load in there.
Oh, okay. So folks who might be adjacent to the river and this particular river is flooding, they would get a message, and it would tell them, get out of your basement because it's likely to flood or something.
Or, you know, evacuate your house.
Hmm. I might join Keith's cautionary note here with a comment about swimming in floodwater. Something about flooding your field or flooding your street makes you want to go swim in it. And we did encounter a number of people out playing in the water. And while it can be fun, we have tremendous volumes of water moving into the stormwater system. And there are washouts. There are already gullies and creeks. And there are times where the water flow can really be dangerous and overtake a swimmer or a wader. And we and others have had drownings during these floodings. And so people really need to be cautious, and especially parents need to be cautious about letting their children out playing in this water. It looks like fun, but it really can be deadly. We're very fortunate we didn't encounter those kinds of consequences this time, but we did have a lot of people out, and we were out trying to caution them and kind of pull them back from especially locations where we thought it might be dangerous.
Chuck, if I could just add a word on to that.
This is Bob Kindred, assistant manager for the city.
Yes, thank you. You know, both as Keith was saying, when people are driving and also when others might want to wade out and just have some of the fun out in the waters, we understand how out in the countryside there may be a washout of a gravel road, and so hopefully people take that seriously. But in town, there are other things that can happen that are every bit as dangerous, maybe more so. In our stormwater system, a storm like we had the other night basically overwhelms it, and there's a tremendous amount of water upstream pushing down through the piping system. And what can happen, it blows manhole covers off. And so the road that normally is just as safe as it could be to walk down or drive down may have something that would trap a car or a person. And then as the system starts to now work properly again, even though the road is covered with water, it could be pulling down. We actually had a drowning here in Ames in 1976 in that very situation where someone was out just playing in the stormwater and was sucked down and trapped in a storm intake. And so, boy, just all the more reason to be careful, and though it may be tempting, don't do it.
My goodness. So basically the storm sewer system was at total capacity, and this was the causing. That's just amazing that it could blow off a manhole cover.
Yeah, yeah. And I should have mentioned the sanitary sewer system can be the same way. So there are actually two different sets of pipes and manholes that could be at risk, and that it doesn't happen everywhere, but it does happen.
Well, and any water that the sanitary sewer system has mingled with is not something you want to be swimming in. So where was the emergency headquarters? I forget what you were calling it.
We opened the Emergency Operations Center in City Hall. It's kind of a core area within the police department. We have we gather the expertise we need in there, and the people are the key. We're there to back up those on-duty crews, get them the resources they need, make sure we're doing what we can for the city. But we also have a fair amount of technology in there, the radios and the computer systems and the information that we need for decision makers are kind of piped into that room. And we'll open that center anytime we're anticipating the potential of these kinds of problems. And then if we really run into something that's stretching our capacity, we'll call in a full Emergency Operations Center crew with staffing from across the city, liaison to emergency management, liaison to Iowa State University, and try to make sure that we're doing what we can to keep the city safe and get everybody kind of back on their feet.
Keith, were there any other communities that had emergency issues surrounding this storm?
We checked in with the other communities, Huxley and down on through Cambridge, and there wasn't. There was a great radar image that I was able to show them, which is storm totals. And there was one white blob, which was over 5 inches of rain, sitting right – you almost could have drawn it within the borders of Ames. Really unique storm in the way that it just dropped everything right here. But we were checking out. And that's one of the differences between my emergency operations center and the city's is – we're servicing Ames, but we also have to service every other community across the county to make sure that their needs are met and to try and think ahead like Ames was. What's the next step after this? Once the water goes down, what do we need to be thinking about?
And so when the water did go down, what kind of cleanup had to be done on a citywide level?
This storm was really quite interesting. Something, if I could jump back, Keith mentioned showing us that graphic that showed the rain coming down. As I recall, about 1 o'clock in the morning, the National Weather Service was also predicting river flooding. So we were trying to gear up for that. And fortunately, that did not occur for the unfortunate reason that most of the rain was right here on top of Ames. But, you know, as that happened, we experienced just street flooding and neighborhood flooding in areas where none of us had ever seen that before in our lifetimes. In contrast, then, to the river floods, there wasn't really damage to public facilities. All of the damage, I think, was pretty much contained with homes and cars, and so private individuals. So in that case, the city doesn't play a direct role, although many of our citizens had the flooded basements to clean out and so forth, and that's been going on for the last week and a half. Thankfully, there are some resources available and perhaps more coming that Keith could describe to try to help those citizens in their recovery.
One of the things that we did after we looked at this, we through the Emergency Management Commission, we declared a local disaster. And that disaster reflects that to be able to help these individuals was beyond our capabilities. And Governor Branstad did declare this as a local state-level disaster, which opened up a program called Iowa's Individual Assistance Program. And that's available to those that, whose income is 200% of the poverty level or below. And it does have some resources up to $5,000 for critical needs for these folks and families. And so far we've had six. The program is administered through Mid-Iowa Community Action. And they've already discussed with six individuals and families the program and starting to enroll them. And they have 11 more people that they're going to be discussing with. So we've been able to help out 17 families. And we're also working with the state. As soon as we're done here, we're going to be talking to FEMA folks about a damage assessment. The threshold for individual assistance from the federal government is extremely high. I would be surprised if we were able to meet that level. But it's worth looking at to make sure that we can identify any resources that might be out there to help out the individuals.
Sure. That's really remarkable. Potentially 17 people that you would help through this extra layer of help. How did you document the fact that this was an emergency beyond the capability of Ames to?
It was a bit surprising because the morning after, well, we didn't think that we had that much, but we found out about one or two, and we put out a press release asking people to call in and give us some basic information on the kinds of damages that they had received, and it made us a lot more aware of damages. If you have a tornado or high winds move through a community, you can drive down the roads and you can look at them, but when it's basement flooding, it's much more difficult. Even river flooding, you can see how high the water gets to before it recedes. This kind of flash flooding and primarily basement damage flooding is very difficult, and that's where we have to rely on the citizens to self-report.
Right. And was this really spread out over the entire area of Ames, or was it concentrated in particular neighborhoods?
We're in the process of mapping it out so that we can look at that sort of stuff, and we'll be providing that information back to Ames so that they can look at it.
Well, that'll be interesting. Well, it sounds like you had a very successful time of dealing with this unusual storm. City of Ames folks, yeah, Chuck and Bob.
Well, thank you. Yeah, you know, we felt that our response was pretty adequate the night of the storm with Keith's help and so many others out in the field working and rescuing and, of course, great citizenry support for their neighbors and so forth. But, you know, one responsibility we as a city feel is to try to do our best to help stormwater not have this kind of effect on our citizens. It was estimated that this storm that Keith was describing was somewhere between a 200 and a 500-year storm. And I just hate to hear those percentages because it happens so much more often. But the truth is our local stormwater system is built to handle 5 to 10-year storms. And, you know, it would cost probably hundreds of millions of dollars to build something bigger. That doesn't mean we don't want to look and see how we can't do better in the future to handle these extreme storm events. But really, we're hopeful that as we work on that as a city, individual property owners will do the same for their properties and see if there aren't protections they can't put in place in their or around their own homes or in their local neighborhoods to try to prevent future flooding.
Okay. Keith had mentioned the Story County Alerts system, the ability to register your phone number and allow us to reach out to you in an emergency. This storm was bad, but another inch or two of rain, it would have been really bad, and a lot of people would have been at risk in their homes. We would have activated that calling system. We would have asked people to shelter in place, probably in high ground. We'd ask them to call in if they needed evacuation. It's a very important method we have of trying to get information out to people quickly, and people who are not registered really need to go to the website, either the city or the county website, or search Story County Alerts and get registered, because we'll use that to get information out to people during the next disaster, whether it's rain or wind or weather. That's become an important tool for us in reaching out and trying to make connections with people who need help.
Okay.
And that system is countywide, so it's not just for Ames. Anybody that lives anywhere in Story County can register for it. Story City, McCallsburg, Maxwell, even those folks can be covered by the system.
Okay. So all you listeners, get on the stick. Get over there onto the Emergency Services website and sign yourself up for those phone alerts. That's all the time we have now. Thank you so much, Chuck Sykaj, Bob Kindred, and, of course, Keith Morgan, our regular contributor. You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I've been your host, Greta Anderson. We started out with conversing with Liz Garst, who has a interesting lecture coming up tonight at 7 p.m., Corn and Khrushchev, A Short History of Iowa Agriculture. That's at Memorial Hall. Then we spoke with Eric McIntyre, conductor and director of Central Iowa Symphony, who has a concert this Saturday, 7:30 p.m. We heard from ACAC, whose studio tour is this weekend, Saturday and Sunday. Also, remember the Ames Got Talent for your kids. If they have talent and want to compete with other kids, go to the Ames Children's Choir website and sign up by October 10th. Finally, we heard from Jerry Hyde about the fleas at the library and our wonderful guest telling us about the flood. Local Talk will be rebroadcast at noon and 7 p.m. You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. There you will also find information about our guests along with relevant links to today's stories. That's khoifm.org. And you can like us on Facebook and get updates on all of our show postings in your newsfeed. Thanks to webmaster Ron Carson for making that possible. Local Talk was engineered by Vince Valeriano. Good job, Vince. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. We also heard Spanish Flea by Herb Alpert. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878. That's 292-2878, or contact us through our website, khoifm.org. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.
HOI is made possible in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. In the heart of Ames, the Ames Main Street Farmers Market brings local food and fun. Located between the 300 and 400 blocks of Main Street, including Tom Evans Plaza, the Farmers Market provides fresh local fruits, veggies, meats, breads, handcrafted goods, live music, and family entertainment every Saturday.